Ukraine's president warns it could lead to a world war. Is Volodymyr Zelensky overreacting when he sounds the alarm over the deployment of North Korean soldiers to Russia? Soldiers that, according to NATO, are destined for Ukraine-occupied parts of Kursk region. Seoul is certainly taking the threat seriously. It's dispatched its defense minister to Washington amid reports of a South Korean delegation expected in Kyiv. Is this the moment where NATO lifts restrictions on the use of its weaponry by Ukraine? How far does the escalation go? And what's in it for Pyongyang's regime, which in the last months has severed channels of mediation, blown up roads across the demilitarized zone? Those garbage-filled balloons aimed at the south may seem comical from afar, but the ratcheting of tensions is no joke. Does Kim Jong-un want war? If so, why? And is the West ready? Today in the France 24 debate, will Russia's war against Ukraine go global? Joining us from the Ukrainian port city of Odessa, Hannah Shaless, director of the security programs at the think tank Ukrainian Prism. Welcome back to the show.
Good evening.
From Washington, former senior U.S. State Department advisor Robert Manning, distinguished fellow at the Stimson Center think tank. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
From Cambridge in England, Peter Hahn, doctoral researcher at the Faculty of Asian and Middle Eastern Studies at Cambridge University. Welcome as well.
Thanks for having me.
Samantha de Bendern is associate fellow at the think tank Chatham House, a former NATO political officer in a previous life. Welcome back.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
By the way, you can catch the show, the audio version of it, wherever podcasts our stream. That's a reminder. Before we ask about Korea, sobering news for Ukraine and its allies. Russia's incremental gains may be gathering steam. This Wednesday, the announcement of an additional 165,000 troops called up by Ukraine. In September, Moscow's forces made their biggest advances since the opening weeks of the all-out invasion back in 2022. Eliza Herbert has more.
Moscow claiming to have taken another town.
We've taken the settlement of Selidoye. Hurrah, hurrah, hurrah.
Selidoye is home to 20,000 people and is the largest of a string of villages claimed by Russian forces in recent days. It adds to the 478 square kilometres of territory seized since the start of October, Russia's highest monthly total since its full-scale invasion began in February 2022. But according to the Institute for the Study of War, the true picture of Russia's recent successes in Ukraine can be characterised by small-scale, localised advances, with significant active fighting largely along the regions of Donetsk and Luhansk. Almost daily, Russia claims a new victory, further pressuring Ukraine's depleted forces. Kyiv announced a drive on Tuesday to mobilise 160,000 troops to boost its numbers by 85%. Its concerns are exacerbated by warnings that Russia is imminently deploying more than 10,000 troops from North Korea. The Ukrainian president says it justifies the use of long-range weapons from the West against Russia.
Some of the countries, they say, oh, it's crossing red lines. And if we will give you permission, Russia will escalate. But I think the North Korean soldier, this is escalation, not from our side, from the side of Russia.
In Moscow, Russian and North Korean officials were set to hold strategic talks.
North Korean Foreign Minister Cho Song-ri is arriving in Moscow on an official visit to hold strategic consultations with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov.
Fueling fears that Russia and North Korea's relationship is growing stronger and poses a global security threat.
By the way, the Pentagon refusing to confirm what CNN reported on Tuesday, that a small number of North Korean troops are already on Ukrainian territory. That's according to two Western intelligence sources who spoke to that media outlet. Hannah Shaless, what's the latest you've heard about the North Koreans?
The latest I heard being the explosion of the ballistic missile in Odessa just 5 minutes ago when I was already waiting for this show. So even with or without North Korea, Russia is accelerating their attacks against Ukraine as soon as they have enough of the ballistic and other type of the rockets. But with the North Korean, what we already know from the intelligence services that the first few thousands arrived to Kursk region. So they're approximately 50 kilometers from the border. Others are at the training stage, at the accommodation stage, at the territory of the Russian Federation, and soon they can be deployed over there. And that some number of them are expected on the south in Kherson region just this week or the next week. So it is like in the process of deployment. And we know that already for a few months, some of them been noticed on the east in the Donetsk region, where they helped and just had the reconnaissance of the situation over there. Some of their engineers, because for the last few months we have the North Korean missiles, not only the small ammunition that we used to have since October last year.
What's your sense? Are they there to do actual fighting or to watch and learn?
No, they are expected to have the actual fighting. And here the situation, like the information that we have as for now, is a little bit, I cannot say confusing, but we need to see what is happening. Because originally it was said that North Korea is sending best of their special forces. That's how it was presented by North Korea itself. However, the intelligence information is that we probably have 10, 20% of them, really of those special forces of North Korea. And others are the regular infantry, youngsters without the proper military experience. But here, you know, when you have up to 10,000, and that the numbers that we are expecting in the near months, that still doesn't matter how inexperienced they are, that is 10,000. And also, we understand that these people are highly motivated with the good discipline, not the same type as many of the Russian conscripts that are arriving to the front line, with the absolutely different logic of being, they will not run away and so on. And that is quite a challenging, and that also can allow Russians just to free some of the forces, their capabilities, for example, from the Kursk region where we have the low intensity, and to bring these Russian 10,000 to the east where we have the high intensity of the battles.
Right. Last week, Ukrainian military intelligence leaking intercepts of phone conversations that pointed, well, to a bit of a rocky start to the collaboration between Russian and North Korean forces. Intercepts that would point to plans to have one interpreter and three senior officers for every 30 North Korean soldiers. That plus some choice explicatives, as you'll see.
И типа он стоит, шарын вылупил, охуел, блядь. Приехал тут. Не знает, говорит, что с ними делать, похуй или что там. Просто суть в том, что Трофимов знает, а мы нихуя не знаем.
Ну он как раз по поводу этого, блядь, батальону К рассказывал. Я говорю, а кто получает, говорю, на них оружие, боеприпасы? Мы, говорю, блядь, получили, нахуй, сухпайки, говорю. А кто, говорю, получает? Я говорю, насколько я слышал, получают бригады, ебать.
Yeah, calling him the K Battalion. Robert Manning, there's a bit of fog of war on both sides. What do you make of these North Korean arrivals?
Well, I think clearly Putin had a deal with Kim Jong-un. We don't know precisely what he's promised Kim in terms of advanced military technology. But he's also trying to avoid another mobilization and having or diverting troops from Donbass to retake Kursk. And so I think that's part of it. I think there's bound to be a huge operational problems, right? We're talking about language, culture, military doctrine, and procedures.
Yeah, and you heard on that point, Hannes Schiller say there's sort of on the one hand, the North Koreans who have not been in battle for 70 years, so and who don't speak the language. On the other hand, the fact that their troops are better disciplined.
Yes, they are. But you know, I wouldn't be at all surprised if we start hearing reports of North Korean troops who refuse to be cannon fodder and try to defect. I think that's another thing to watch for. But I think the larger, there's a large impact on the balance of power in the on the Korean Peninsula, and I think that the South Koreans are very very concerned about this, because North Korea is getting more aggressive since the failed Trump Kim summit in 2019. They've had a huge missile and nuclear buildup. And I think they see themselves as emboldened by this partnership with Russia. And we expect launching some aggressive military actions around the Korean Peninsula in coming months.
Yeah, we're going to get back across back to the to what happens exactly on the peninsula itself. Peter Han, what do you make of Kim Jong-un dispatching some 10 to 12,000 troops? That's what's expected to the Ukrainian front.
It's definitely alarming. And let me just go back to the comments made by Hannah and Robert. I think Hannah mentioned that it's really confusing at this stage regarding the quality of the troops being deployed, as well as what Robert just mentioned, that there are a lot of huge operational problems that North Korean soldiers may face. And one of the things that I would like to add is that they're not trained in a plain terrain kind of environment. North Korea is very mountainous and hilly. And obviously, if they're being deployed in a plain and terrain where they are, they may not be as used to what they are. They have been trained. So that's another element that we could think of. Obviously, Kim Jong-un is not doing this for goodwill. That's my take. He is expecting something from Russia. Probably they have discussed this in detail between the summit, as well as we see that Choi Sang-hee, the North Korean foreign minister, is just met Sergei Lavrov in Moscow. So probably North Korea want to gain something out of these troop deployment. Some of the things that we could speculate at this stage would be satellite technology transferred from Russia, nuclear weapon-related technologies, or intercontinental ballistic missiles technology as well. And another, some experts have even pointed out that this could be a good cash flow for Kim Jong-un, because the soldiers, the North Korean soldiers being deployed, will get paid. And that and a lot of a huge sum of money will be going directly to the regime. So this could be one way out for Kim Jong-un, who's now financially struggling at this stage.
So is this mercantile, or does Kim Jong-un want a war?
It's at this stage, obviously, it's not clear, because as you just mentioned, you know, there's a fog of war between both sides. But the degree of the soldiers being trained is we're still quite unsure to what extent they're actually special forces, right? So I would be very hesitant to say that they're mercenaries. And I would also be cautious to say whether this will be blown out into a full-scale war between North Korea, including North Korea, to this battlefield. Because as soon as North Korea gets from Russia what they want, probably North Korea may not wish to escalate this even further, because we've seen multiple reports saying that Kim Jong-un is actually controlling the domestic public so well that they are not being informed of this North Korean engagement in Ukraine.
And that's on that score, are you expecting desertions?
Obviously, yes, because North Korean... obviously, that's why Kim Jong-un is making sure that these people are probably domestically, because North Korean economy is struggling so much, there is a public, growing public dissent among North Korean people. Obviously, I'm very cautious here because I haven't been to North Korea at this stage, so we don't know what's actually happening at the ground level. But according to, I could point out to the recent studies made by Victor Cha. I think he wrote a book recently about what North Korean people actually feel about the regime. And he did micro-surveys. And one of the interesting findings of that survey is that North Korean people actually have dissents towards the government and the regime. That's not being captured easily by any official level. But at least on the grassroots level, there are growing popular oppositions toward what Kim Jong-un is doing. And precisely that's why Kim Jong-un is not willing to disclose any information about these troops being deployed in Ukraine.
All right. Tuesday at an ice cream store in Baltimore, Maryland, the outgoing U.S. President Joe Biden was asked about the deployment. Let's take a listen.
I'm concerned about it, yes.
Should the Ukrainians strike back?
They cross into Ukraine, yes.
Yes, they should. They'll be fair game, says his spokesperson. Joe Biden concerned, yes, but for now no sign in public in the United States of lifting restrictions on the use of long-range missiles deep inside of Russia's territory. Samantha De Bendern, how much of an escalation is this?
I think if you look at it on a global point of view, it is definitely an escalation. First of all, you have this unprecedented move by North Korea to send men, to send regular soldiers. These are not volunteers. You have foreign volunteers in the Ukrainian army. These are regular soldiers who are being given Russian army uniforms to fight Russia's war.
So it's more like the Foreign Legion than foreign mercenaries.
Well, this is just incorporating foreigners into the army under that army's uniform. So yes, this is unprecedented. But if you look at it on a more global scale, the really important thing here is Russia and North Korea have signed a treaty, a mutual assistance treaty. What this treaty is, a kind of reproduction of NATO. It's a mutual defense treaty. So if one is attacked, the other one will come to the other one's defense. This means, in a way, that if North Korea were to have some kind of military confrontation with South Korea, South Korea could find itself at war with Russia. South Korea, which is the US's ally in Southeast Asia. So this, in a way, this is an escalation of the involvement, of the international involvement of countries far away from Ukraine in this war. And to underline this, the South Koreans sent a high-level delegation to NATO headquarters yesterday to talk about the implications. The NATO Secretary General has talked about the risk that this poses to stability in Europe and in NATO's Indo-Pacific partners. So in that sense, yes, it is an escalation, not necessarily for the Ukrainian front. We don't know what effect these North Korean troops will have in Ukraine or in the Kursk region, which is the part of Russia which Ukraine has invaded, where a lot of people think these North Koreans will initially be deployed. It is an escalation of the globalization of this war.
Unfortunately, you brought your crystal ball to this discussion. So how will the West react to this?
Well, you know, the West has reacted in a rather lame way so far to the beginning of this war in Ukraine. Now, this might shock certain viewers who are hearing constantly about Western weapons going to Ukraine. The Western weapons that have gone to Ukraine so far have been sufficient to make sure that Ukraine doesn't completely collapse, but not sufficient for Ukraine to win this war. When Joe Biden says that Ukraine can respond if North Korean troops are on Ukrainian territory, I mean, this sounds actually surreal. Of course Ukraine will respond if North Korean troops are on its territory. Why does Joe Biden even have to say that? It's Ukraine's sovereign right to do so. So, and the reason he said this is because there have been constant limitations put on Ukraine as to how Ukraine can defend itself. America is giving Ukraine weapons, but saying, sorry, but you can't use them under certain circumstances, and you can use them under other circumstances, while Ukrainian cities are getting bombed on a daily basis.
So that's the view from Samantha on the West. Robert Manning, what about China? Bilateral agreement between Russia and North Korea. How do they feel about it in Beijing?
Well, the Chinese are rather unhappy about it. I think that I was from China last month and talked to a lot of people, and first of all, they don't trust Putin. They see Russia as a disruptor, and their main concern for 30 years, number one at the priority list, has been stability on the Korean Peninsula. For example, probably a main reason why North Korea hasn't conducted a seventh nuclear test, which many people have speculated on for the last couple of years, is because China made it clear that was a red line. Now, what happens if he just the test again and Putin says it's okay with me and Russia can provide fuel, grain, military technology? And so the Chinese are a bit concerned about this. And I think it will and otherwise have taken, particularly provocative military action against South Korea. And I think more broadly, talked about the globalization of the Ukraine war. I mean, it's tempting to see it as similar to the Italian and German fascists intervening in the Spanish Civil War in 1935, right? That was another period sort of interregnum between eras. And you wonder if maybe that's where we are now.
An interregnum between eras. You agree, Peter Hahn?
I do agree with the assessment that North Korea's nuclear test is a red line for China. But at the same time, to what extent North Korea will make further provocations is something that we need to watch out for. And what I can say at this stage is that for South Korean perspective, I think, speaking of red lines, I think the government official made a comment today that for South Korea, they haven't really set the red line for the North Korean behaviors at this stage, but they will respond to the North Korea's situation with restraint and step-by-step procedure. And the first step they said is that if North Korea participates in a combat situation in Ukraine, that will be the first step. So at least from the South Korean perspective, I could say that that could be the starting point of South Korea considering additional measures.
Right. And South Korean defense minister is in Washington as we speak. Kim Jong-un greeted at the Pentagon by his U.S. counterpart, Lloyd Austin, while a South Korean delegation is, after briefings in Brussels on Tuesday, as Samantha was saying, with the EU, with NATO, expected to travel on to Kyiv at this point in time. First, let me start with you, Samantha. Hannah Schalest. What are Ukrainians hoping from the South Koreans?
First of all, let me just one sentence regarding the previous statements. We are not in the Spanish Civil War, as there is no civil war in Ukraine. We're already in 1939, if we would like to have the analogy, because it is the open Russian aggression and the involvement of different countries. But if we speak about the South Korea, Ukraine started to work with South Korea a year ago, when the first information about the North Korean ammunition came and we saw the ammunition striking Ukrainian cities. But for South Korea, it was very difficult to do the open support in addition to the political that we had from the day one because of the two reasons. First, according to their legislation, they cannot supply weapons to the country in war. The second reason is because they didn't want to provoke Russia that can help the North Korea. And they hope for the balance that North Korea will keep with just supplying some missiles and other type of the ammunition to Russia. However, they already at that time allowed the U.S. to take some of their weapons from Korea and to deliver it to Ukraine. And the second is they delivered the Krab equipment to Poland, and we received it from Poland. So indirect, plus the intelligence service contacts being for the whole year. The last months, we know that the South Korean advisors started to consult more and more with Ukrainian special forces and intelligence. It's not only exchange of the information, but that's also preparation of the different materials, how to work with the North Koreans. So what is the tactics, how they work? So exchange of this type of the information. And even you could see the last week, they demonstrated the certain type of the, how to say, the toolkit, the basic phrases for Ukrainian armed forces how to refer to the North Koreans, for example, how to propose them to surrender or how to take them. So we definitely know that a certain level of the communication already been happening, not at the public level, but also the public statements. You know, it was very interesting recent development when the 200 of the ex-North Korean defectors openly called for the Ukrainian government that they are ready to come to Ukraine and to help Ukrainian government with the North Korean forces in terms of the information, in terms of the communication when it would be necessary with them, and even being deployed. So we definitely will see more public pressure probably inside of South Korea to react to these recent developments, and maybe for the military support as well, but not direct, because for this you need the change of the South Korean legislation. We see the certain groups within the parliament. I remember my trip to Seoul last December. We discussed it with the members of parliament. They were going to discuss the possibilities to change this legislation about the direct supply during the war. And the deployment of the North Koreans, it is that serious step forward that activate, enhance these discussions within the parliament, how to change the South Korean legislation.
Robert Manning, we're getting statements now from those discussions between the U.S. Defense Secretary and the South Korean Defense Minister, who says he doesn't believe that North Korea-Russia ties increase the risk of war on the Korean Peninsula. However, and this harks back to what you were saying a short while ago, he's expecting some kind of an intercontinental ballistic missile test around the time of the U.S. elections. In other words, next week.
Yeah, Kim views events, particular events in America as fun opportunities to poke the U.S. in the eye. July 4th, Independence Day, Christmas, an election period. And so I wouldn't at all be surprised if we saw an ICBM test.
But that's, of course, not the same as what you were saying, a nuclear test.
Well, I wouldn't. If he thinks he needs a nuclear test, a lot of people speculate that they don't need to do any more tests. And also their nuclear test site is clashed after the last test. We haven't seen signs that they've completely refurbished it. So that's a consideration. But I think that, their solid fuel nuclear ICBM missiles are something they're trying to perfect, because that's really their trump card against the U.S. if they to try to deter the U.S. from intervening in a conflict.
Right, and there's a lot of worry over what's going on, both on in Ukraine and on the Korean Peninsula. 2 weeks ago, Pyongyang blew up two unused roads that link the two Koreas through the demilitarized zone. It's a symbolic move, but it was again well choreographed and a reminder that that line of demarcation, the DMZ, is born not out of a peace treaty, but an armistice signed in 1953. Officially, the two Koreas still at war. Is there the sense, because, sorry to borrow the term interregnum, Peter Han, we're kind of waiting to find out who the next U.S. president will be. Whoever it is, it won't be sworn in, he or she won't be sworn in until January. You have this moment where, as Samantha de Bendern was saying, in Europe, they're hesitant to step up their support against Russia's invasion, that Kim might think this is the moment to have a little war.
Well, to put this in the context, I think that'll be very useful for us to see whether Kim Jong-un is actually preparing for a war. So January this year, Kim Jong-un said that, it raised the terms like Minjok, which is the ethnic group, the Korean race, because that's the terminology that North Koreans have been using to justify their position on unification, because we're the same race, same people, we need to get unified. And Kim Jong-un said, erase that from our textbooks, and also said, designate South Korea as a principal enemy. And starting from then, we saw a lot of, slowly but gradually, Kim Jong-un was moving away from the idea of unification. And now we saw the bombing of the roads that being connected, and that's being made possible by South Korean investment over the previous administrations. So and Kim Jong-un can't mobilize the domestic people to go on a war in South Korea overnight. If he has that plan, it needs to be very gradual and very phased approach may be envisioned. And that's what we are exactly seeing at the moment. He's trying to erasing the concept of unification from the North Korean people and to also sending out the message and making it clear to the South Korean public and to the government that they are not considering any conciliatory or unification-related initiatives in the near future. So I'm still very hesitant to label this as a war preparation, but we are slowly saying goodbye in terms of our friendly relationship.
Very worrying signs, Samantha Nabendran.
Sorry?
Very worrying signs.
It's very worrying. One of the theories that has been put forward as to what Pyongyang is getting out of this deployment of troops in Russia and potentially in Ukraine is that it will give a North Korean troops experience of fighting against the Ukrainians who are American-trained, some of them, who are using U.S. weapons. So it would give them direct experience of fighting the kind of army they would have to fight if they were to fight South Korea. So this could be because nothing can replace battlefield experience. And North Korean army has not fought outside North Korea, well, really, ever since North Korea existed.
7 years.
Apart from, you know, it has small incursions North Vietnam, the pilots in North Vietnam in the 1960s. But it has not been outside North Korean territory. None of these active soldiers have any kind of experience. What we've also been hearing from the ground is that some of the men who were there are being exposed for the first time to drone warfare, something that they would also be exposed to if they were to fight in South Korea. So this adds to the sense that this really is a kind of globalization of this war, not to mention the psychological factor to the Ukrainians to see that on the one hand, the US and Europe is still hesitant. We know the German chancellor is hesitant. The US are embroiled in their own election cycle. And on the other hand, their enemy is making new friends and getting new, fresh troops from a foreign country that no NATO member will do to help Ukraine. And that we can.
Is there
going to
be a response from NATO?
Right now, I don't see it. Perhaps after the election, some of the restrictions will be lifted and Ukraine may be allowed to use the weapons it has to strike deeper into Russian territory if Kamala Harris wins, if Donald Trump wins. I really don't see that happening. So as for the Europeans, the one country that can provide new, longer-range missiles right now are the Germans. They have been very clear that they do not want to even provide these to Ukraine. France and the UK would be in favour of lifting some of the restrictions, but they can't do that without US approval because the US controls some of the satellite navigation systems on these missiles. So the European response has been quite extraordinary. Here we have a North Korean troops potentially about to enter a European country that is our ally, that could potentially even go as far as the borders of the European Union or NATO. And we're kind of sitting back, still thinking about what we can authorize Ukraine to do or not. It is quite surreal. If this were a Monty Python sketch, it would probably seem to be too far-fetched. Sadly, it's reality.
Robert Manning, I know you have to leave us. So just one brief last question for you. At this point in time, can the West do anything during this sort of, again, you brought up the term, interregnum, this period where we're all waiting to see who wins the U.S. presidential election?
Well, I think in terms of, as you just said, on Ukraine, there are things we can do. But in terms of elections, I don't see much that's likely to happen on the part of the U.S. or Europe, this is kind of immunized against any practical reaction on the ground.
Robert Manning, thanks for joining our conversation. Sorry you have to leave us slightly earlier than the end. You know, we're talking about how much rides at stake are in those U.S. elections. This week, we saw there was, or rather a couple of weeks back, there was the Washington Post, not the Washington Post, excuse me, the Wall Street Journal, reported that since late 2022, Donald Trump supporter Elon Musk has held a series of secret conversations with Vladimir Putin, reporting that the owner of SpaceX and Twitter has reporting that he's pushed back on that reporting. But he's also, Hannah Schelest, the owner of the Starlink low-orbit satellite system, which proved invaluable to the Ukrainians at the start of Vladimir Putin's all-out invasion in February 2022. Your thoughts, if Donald Trump wins, what happens?
I mean, there are a lot of things can happen, and definitely we hope that Elon Musk would not receive any official position, because his position dramatically changed since 2022. Originally, he supported Ukraine and was, according to the international law and the just sound mind, but then for the last 2 years, we saw the dramatic evolution of his opinion. Already, we saw it in Twitter that all Ukrainian accounts are really suppressed, while the Russian media just received a softened condition a week ago when the state-sponsored media mark being removed even from Madame Simonyan. But then...
The head of the news outlet RT...
Yeah, and now we are, like, for the last 2 years, we also had the problems with Starlink that started when the several operations being almost cancelled or failed because Starlink suddenly stopped working near Crimea. Then the Pentagon needed even to take control of some parts of the Starlink that is in charge of the military activities. Let's say there were certain divisions inside civilian and military contracts. There were certain conversations with Elon Musk, how his company can lose the contracts of Pentagon. We had a little bit of the improvement of the situation, but now we have the third wave when the Russians started using Starlink quite actively. We know that it is the great expert, but the Starlink is not doing anything. It can be like indirect demonstration, but when you have key statements, when you have information like Wall Street Journal report, when you have these facts on the ground, both with the Twitter X and with the Starlinks and with the some other contracts, you understand that definitely the position of one man of control of the strategic enterprises can be very dangerous, not only for Ukraine and for our development, but we understand that the American armed forces had a lot of contracts with the same company and the same person. So that can have a long-term effect and much wider than just consequences for Ukrainian battlefields.
Peter Hahn, strange times we live in with so much uncertainty, both in the Pacific and here in Europe.
Yes, and if there's one lesson that I can draw this from the whole the recent developments, there is a saying that, you know, North Korean observers say when watching North Korea, it's not dog wagging the tail, it's its tail. Wailing the dog. So you can see that however small North Korea may be, however small it may be to the outside observers, it could actually tries to exert influence over serious matters around the world, including the current conflict in the Russian and Ukraine. So I think that has been quite constant in terms of North Korea's strategy.
It's easy to underestimate North Korea when we laugh at the garbage filled balloons and this sort of thing. We underestimate it.
I think we can be easily blinded by the fact that there are so many things that North Korea is doing is not up to the standards that we expect. But at the same time, they can actually think outside of the box and bite you back.
Samantha DeBendren?
Yes, I mean, you know, North Korea is often portrayed as this very poor country where there are even parts of the country that have famine, but they managed to get the bomb. Countries like Iran and Syria, who are in a very, very different league to North Korea, haven't managed to do it. So, yes, we should not underestimate North Korea, nor should we underestimate Kim Jong-un's ambitions in terms of potential war with the South. And I also find it quite... It's very sadly ironic that we are talking about North and South Korea with this demilitarized zone, because that is exactly one of the futures that Ukraine is fearing, that there will be a North-South Korea-type division in Ukraine. That is also practically the plan that J.D. Vance has talked about if he becomes vice president and Donald Trump becomes president. He's saying we will have demilitarized zones between in eastern Ukraine and well, there's a Russian-occupied eastern Ukraine and Ukraine. Ukraine, but Ukraine would be neutral, so it would not even have the benefit that South Korea has of being an ally of the United States with sort of proper United States military protection. So this whole implication of the two Koreas in this war is, I hope it is not a presage of what could be the end of the war in Ukraine.
Hannah Celeste?
Yeah, the situation is definitely developing, and that's quite an interesting that we constantly hear about the red lines for Ukraine, what we cannot do not to escalate the situation. But nobody is speaking about the red lines for the Russian Federation, what they are doing that will finally change the position of our partners. We are waiting for the elections. We understand that, unfortunately, we became there in the trap of the U.S. elections, domestic policies. But the problem is much bigger. And it's not just the U.S. elections, but the position of a lot of leaders around the NATO countries who are afraid of Mr. Putin that much that they are becoming a much better defense for Russia than the Russian forces themselves. And for us as Ukrainians, now is the huge challenge how to change this situation.
Yeah, it's coming on a day when you've had, again, this... A call-up of an extra 165,000 troops in Ukraine. Russia talking about more incremental gains in the east. At this point in time, what will reverse the situation?
First of all, is definitely the permission to strike at the Russian territory. First of all, because that demonstrates the Russian vulnerabilities. The second, because that's allowed to break the supply lines and the ammunition depots and the airplanes. Because you can use the 25 interception of the missiles, or you can use one strike and break and destroy the jet that is sending these missiles to Ukraine. So that's also the question of the efficiency of using resources that we have as for now. And then definitely we need to think about the new type of the ammunition, what type, and the proper supply. The biggest problem, and that's one of the reasons we have collapse at some of the places in eastern Ukraine, because it is not a stable supply of ammunition. So when you have the active battle and then suddenly you're limited with your resources, you cannot continue the proper battle. And it doesn't allow you to have the proper defense of the territories as well.
We'll have to leave it there, unfortunately. So much more to talk about. I want to thank you, Hannah Celeste, for being with us from Odessa. I want to thank Peter Hahn in Cambridge, Samantha DeBendren. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.